But next, we're going to turn to our Left in the Law duo, Mike Snedeker and Jan Hawken, talking about Senate Bill 1013. Jan?
Well, Mike, as an appellate lawyer working on death penalty appeals, you have two Oregon cases, people on death row. And as of January of this year, there are 30 inmates on death row. And so the new law passed this summer in August, signed by Governor Kate Brown, has important implications for those lives and others who are convicted under the death penalty. So let's talk about what that law means and its limits. But first, just give us an update on the death penalty laws in Oregon. There's been a moratorium since Governor Kitzhaber signed one or announced one in 2011 that's held since then. But give us a summary of where we are with the death penalty in Oregon before we talk about this new law.
Well, the law in Oregon, it was based on the law in Texas. It passed in the 80s, and then it was modified in the 90s. But it provides that people who commit aggravated murder of 12 different kinds are eligible for death. A death penalty trial has two stages. One of them, the eligibility stage, is supposed to be very narrow. You pick from all the tens of thousands of murders the worst of the worst. And then, but once you've got that small number, in theory, then the process of selecting someone for death is as wide as the ocean. Anybody can put on any evidence that might move a juror to vote for a sentence of less than death. And the prosecutors, in turn, can, quote, smear defendants. They can be like kids in a candy store, according to one DA, telling judges how broad the opportunities are for the prosecution to smear and make someone appear death worthy. So those in Oregon, like in Texas, the main criterion for selecting somebody for death is whether or not he or she poses a future danger. Now, that's always been controversial.
Yeah, psychologists, forensic psychologists who are in business to make such predictions are roundly criticized by those who argue their prediction of dangerousness is very difficult. The best prediction is past behavior, but if you don't have, most people don't kill people often enough to establish a pattern, other than people in the military, of course.
Well, that's precisely why a big challenge was made to the law in Texas. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, practically speaking, well, we have to make these choices. We do it every day. Is somebody going to commit a crime? Should we give them bail and let them get out? Are we going to give them probation? He said, the right way to do it is not to exclude information showing somebody poses a future danger, but to allow the defendant to cross-examine them and present his or her own evidence showing how full of hooey most of these predictions are, and how, in truth, according to the American Psychiatric Association, flipping a coin would work just as well. So the law has allowed this, and it has been, you know, under steady attack here in Oregon, as has the Oregon death penalty itself. Because for one, there are so many aggravated murders that the difference between an aggravated murder and a regular murder has essentially disappeared. People have argued.
Can you explain, other than reading the definition from a legal standpoint, what can you give us some of the nuances of that distinction, an aggravated murder versus other kinds of murders?
Well, until the law was changed, any murder committed in the course of a felony was an aggravated murder, and that's way more than half of all murders.
And the aggravated part involves intentionality.
No. That's precisely a point, that you can, if somebody dies in the course of a felony being committed, you are automatically the committer of an aggravated murder, whether you had any intention for anyone to die. So the
aggravation is the other in the course of committing another crime.
Right. That is the aggravation. Whether or not it should be or not, that has been, in fact, considered that way. And the 12 categories are so broad and inclusive that there's almost impossible to find a murder that cannot be charged as an aggravated murder. So therefore, you've got complete discretion in the hands of the prosecutor to pick who shall be sentenced to charge with a death penalty.
Because most murders are committed in the context of some other distressing motivated situation.
The broad categories, like the murders of a sexual partner who's leaving you, murders committed in the, or deaths committed in the course of robbing a 7-Eleven store, these kind of things are all considered to be, under Oregon's definition, aggravated, and therefore you can be charged with the death penalty. Then once you're charged with the death penalty, the process of selecting who's going to actually be executed is a process of picking out the whole question of future dangerousness is critical.
It just opens it up. So the model was to have a narrow funnel in the entry, but then it's kind of a free game for legal maneuvering and manipulation of juries once you're in that door of meeting that criteria.
Exactly.
So how did the new law change those criteria of aggravated murder?
Well, it immediately made all aggravated murders in the past non-aggravated in the sense that they were all dropped down to where the maximum sentence would be first-degree murder. They were all made regular murder convictions, and they were replaced with four new crimes: terrorism, killing of a person by a prisoner who's already killed another person, the killing of a child, the most dramatic change in some senses was the fact that the whole question of future dangerousness now no longer matters. That's not a basis for finding somebody eligible for death or selecting them for death.
There are a lot of forensic psychologists who've been consulting on this question are going to be out of business.
That's right. But they will be able to continue, but they'll have to shift their vocabulary.
So how you're saying this is an important change. It's not, you know, many reforms are have this effect of seeming to refine and address a problem while putting its legitimacy on new footing. So how would you evaluate this reform in the law in terms of its whether it continues to legitimize the death penalty by narrowing it, making it seem more rational, or moving us away entirely from capital punishment?
I think it has a profound effect, more profound than the drafters of the legislation knew, because what it does is define crimes that were death-worthy crimes as not being death-worthy crimes. And therefore, if any of the people who are now on death row are to be executed, they would be executed in the future for having committed a crime that's not a death penalty crime. And there was work done in Connecticut where a similar law passed that was supposedly prospective only, that showed that no one in this country, no one anywhere else in the world has been executed for having committed a crime that is not a death-worthy crime at the time they were executed.
But that's part of the controversy over this new law.
Exactly.
And the debate that actually led to avoiding a legislative session to discuss it, because it was so controversial, the question of whether this would be retroactive, its implications for those who are on death row now. So why is that controversial here? You're saying without question it would be retroactive. It recalibrates the whole situation for those cases on death row.
Well, it's definitely, when you say without question, I mean, there are a million questions. The prosecutorial community rose up in a high dudgeon once they became aware of an opinion by the state attorney general that someone whose case was ongoing, they hadn't already been convicted, but they were charged with, and they had a case involving one of the prior aggravated murder cases, the AG was saying, well, we can't really proceed on this because this is not any longer a death penalty, death-worthy law, or it doesn't make you eligible for death.
And you would say, yes, that's the
case.
Well,
the prosecutors were very upset, and they mustered a supporter in the Oregonian and other people to complain about this and say there should be another legislative session to fix this problem. But the way I read the law, the problem cannot be fixed if you're because it's not truly a problem. If you are going to execute somebody for a crime that's no longer on the books, you're going to be doing something absolutely unprecedented, and that would violate the Eighth Amendment. It would be cruel and unusual. It would be unprecedented, and therefore the notion of evolving standards of decency and rarity, singling somebody out to be the first person in the history of this country to ever be executed for a crime that is no longer a death penalty crime, would be a stretch. So there are two clumps of people. One, those who have already been thoroughly processed by the system, and the other, whose cases are in process now. I think, in truth, that both these people will have a great claim that the new law prevents them from being executed because of not only the Eighth Amendment problems, but how arbitrary it would be. If you were to commit a crime on September 28th and be eligible for death, why should you not be eligible for death on September 29th?
So part of the discourse around this that's important is another manifestation of the arbitrariness as well as a systematic racism and
exactly
irrationalities of the worst penalty possible under the law. Yeah.
Well, my guess would be that as time works out, there will not be any executions of any of the people convicted under the old law, regardless of whether or not Governor Brown changes her mind about the moratorium.
Okay, this is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking today about capital punishment and the death penalty in Oregon and the new law signed by the governor in August that restricts the death penalty and the importance of that as a meaningful reform.